Welcome to the TrueDemocracy.Global podcast. Today, I'm excited to have Dr. Rick Cromie, author of Gen Tech, An American Story of Technology, Change, and Who We Really Are. This is an insightful analysis of technology history since 1900 and how it relates to cultural shifts with each new generation. Today, we hope to learn how technology relates to these cultural shifts and where it might lead us tomorrow into the TrueDemocracy.Global mission and vision, I hope we'll see. The TrueDemocracy.Global podcast, where we are looking into different aspects and systems of democracy, systems of authority and community, as well as the technologies that support them. Our hope is that through understanding, applying shared knowledge and evolving technology, that we can find ways to build trust and encourage constructive collaboration, which may bring about greater freedom for humanity and a true democracy where the power stems truly from the people and everyone has a voice in collaboration with their fellow humans, men and women of any background. We live in an unprecedented time in history with technologies that have never before existed that may help bring about this vision. With me today, Dr. Rick Cromie. Rick uses historical insights and cultural inspiration to empower audiences to rethink and imagine how they lead, teach, pastor, and parent. Besides his book that we're going to talk about today, with over 30 years of experience training, Dr. Rick Cromie is a sought-after speaker both nationally and internationally. He has also penned over a dozen books on leadership, culture, history, classroom management, creative communication, and of course, including his most recent book, Gen Tech, An American Story of Technology, Change, and Who We Really Are. Cromie enjoys collecting antique technology, pop culture, watching baseball, riding his motorcycle, traveling and writing. He lives with his wife, Linda, an adorable dog, an ornery cat in a small town outside of Boise, Idaho. Welcome, Rick.
Hey, thanks, Jay. It's good to be here. And with all of your listeners out there in podcast land,
welcome
to this show, the True Democracy Global Project here.
So I'm going to go off on a tangent right away.
All right, let's do it.
Boise, Idaho.
Right.
Who do you watch? Who's your baseball team out there?
Well, we don't have a real baseball team here. Because of the Californians that have moved up into this area, there's a lot of Dodger fans, a lot of Giants fans. But I lived for several years in St. Louis. And once you get the blood of the Cardinal Nation in you, you just don't go anywhere else. So I've been a diehard Cardinal fan for a long, long time.
Okay. And it sounds like you get the Giant Dodger rivalry up out there too.
Yeah. They're good people. Dodgers they've had some pretty good teams the last 2 years, so you can't fault them. They've done pretty well.
Yeah. Okay.
Cardinals look good this year though.
Yeah. Okay. Before we go too far off on that road, let's reel it back in.
All right.
And talk about technology. I'm interested in the evolution of technology, mainly how it relates to our relationship to authorities and the trust of authorities. Is that something we could talk about?
Sure. And you know, feel free. I look at this as a conversation, so we can just open it up and see where we go here. But really, every technology has an immediate when it starts to bubble, when it starts to tip. I call them tipping points in my book. There's always a counter reaction to the technology that views it with distrust. We saw it with the telephone. I mean, that's one of the earliest technologies I talk about in my book is the telephone. There were people that really felt like this was demonic almost because a voice was coming through the air into your ear. And so it should have been resisted. It felt the same way about even the automobile. You know, the people who rode horses and did the wagon thing felt like that was more of a pure transportation, quieter transportation for sure than the motorized vehicle. But everything, and in particular, when we get into communication technologies like radio and television, eventually the internet, all of those have been met with opposition that initially, and you know, in time, basically we start to accept the new normal. I often have my audiences when I'm doing a workshop, I'll have them fold their hands and look down and see which thumb is on top. And then I'll say, now take your hands apart and put the opposite thumb on top. And how does that feel? And yeah, I can see you shaking your head already, Jay. People don't like that, but this is what change feels like. This is what technological change feels like. And of course we don't like it, but the longer you hold your hands like this, the less intrusive it becomes, the less oppositional it becomes. You start to accept it. We're seeing that right now, I think, as we come out of this COVID moment. You know, we're starting to see the shift has been made rather suddenly, and there's a lot of reactions, of course, but as we come out of it, this new normal is going to play fairly well, and we're gonna figure it out.
Yeah, that's definitely going to be a cultural shift coming out of COVID and the online platforms supporting us over this period. It's going to be it's going to be a permanent shift, I think.
Yeah, well, and the way to look at technological change as well as cultural change is it always has what I call micro movements. They're small movements. When we look back, and as a historian, I look back and I see the macro movements, and that's where we can see the big wholesale changes that have occurred. But if you start to look at it with micro vision, so to speak, you see these micro movements. And with COVID, for example, think about how grocery shopping has changed. My wife and I, before COVID, I was the one that got the groceries. I would literally go to my local grocery store, Walmart or whatever it was, and I would go through the aisle and I pick my own groceries. Now we have personal pickers that do that for us. And then they put it in boxes. And then they give me a ding on my cell phone and I go pick it up. And I never go into the store. There was a period during COVID where I didn't go into my grocery store or a Walmart, I think, for 6 months. It wasn't necessary. Everything was happening. So I thought maybe when we came out of COVID that we'd go back to the way it was. And that's what I'm finding. We're not. We've become very comfortable with that type of grocery delivery. Restaurants had to change. You're seeing in even the entertainment industry in particular, I think we're going to see less tours. Before COVID, everybody did a tour. I mean, that's how you did business as a musician. But what happened during COVID is we realized that we could actually go directly to our audience through, video technology and now holographic technology that's emerging. That's going to totally revolutionize how we concert, you might say.
Mm-hmm. I don't know much about holographic technology. You want to talk about that real quick? I want to get us back to some communication technology, but.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, if you've been watching the Olympics and you caught the opening ceremonies of the Beijing Olympics, you saw holographic technology. We saw them last summer as well in the opening ceremonies there, but the holographic technology in the Beijing Olympics opening ceremonies, it was falling snowflakes and they look so real. And that's where holograms are going to go. We're talking right now through screens. I'm looking at you through my laptop screen, but those screens are going to go away. The physical screen, probably in the next 10 to 15 years, is going to start to disappear, and holographic screens will take their place. I was reading about a smartphone that they're working on, a prototype where, normally you look at your smartphone and you see the face and you have the conversation, through the smartphone, but there's going to be a holographic prototype where it basically is a 3D image of the person you're talking to popping up and you're looking at them just like I'm looking at you, and it's a 3D. So you can turn it around, see the back of their head, everything, it's going to be, it's very interesting. That's what's coming. And again, these are small micro movements. But when we start to look back, we're going to go, whoa, it's not the year 2000 anymore. Yeah. It's not even the year 2020 anymore.
No doubt the change in the past 20 years or so has just been outstanding and mm-hmm. hard to keep up with. Now, you talk about the tipping point Is there an average time or a time span that this tipping point happens with the adoption of technology?
You know, the tipping point can be a long time. I think what's happening now, our tipping points are getting much faster though, Jay.
Yeah.
They are really getting much faster. And that's because our world technologically is spinning faster than ever. When you go back into history, and again, as a historian, I love to look at tipping points in history. The Gutenberg press is a good example. It was created, invented in the mid-1300s, but really did not see its tipping point until the Protestant Reformation. That was when the Gutenberg press really took off. So the tipping point was probably late 1400s, early 1500s with the Protestant Reformation. So, I mean, we're talking about 100, 150 years. Then you move the television. Television, you know, well, it had early inventions. I mean, depending whether you're looking at mechanical or electronic television, they were going different directions. But eventually the electronic television became the kind of the direction. But it wasn't until the 1939 World's Fair that they really, that NBC at that point demonstrated, electronic television to the public. That was our first time when we put eyeballs on it. Well, that's interesting, because it wasn't really until 1960 that most American homes now had a television. So what is that? 21 years we have. It took the internet only about 5 years to find a tipping point.
Wow.
Okay. That's the difference. Yeah. It took social media about 2 years to find a tipping point. The smartphone did it in about 2 or 3 years, found a tipping point. So technology today is moving much faster, and the tipping points are coming much closer together. Yeah.
Right. Let's go back to the television. What were the cultural shifts that happened with the television?
Well, the biggest cultural shift is we moved out of an audio, or what I would call an oral type of culture, mm-hmm. where we listened, we heard, everything came through what we read, the print culture, or it came through what we heard. The radio actually, and motion picture to a certain extent helped that. But the most, what was different about the television, the motion picture, you had to go someplace. Television started the great decentralization. Actually, radio started the great decentralization. Again, technology tends to evolve. Radio evolved into television, if you're thinking about this clearly, because what we call prime time in television was already prime time on the radio.
Okay.
The radio became the central. I mean, we're watching the Waltons right now in our home. My mother-in-law loves the Waltons, and so we're watching the Waltons. And every night they gather around the radio like we gather around a TV. Mm-hmm. That's what they did in the 1930s. They got all their news from the radio. They got all their they got sports from the radio. They got entertainment from the radio. They got their religion from the radio. It really was a centralizing place where they come together. But what happened with television was it started to shift. I mean, the motion picture, that's where newsreels. I mean, if you wanted to get the news, you went to a motion picture, went and saw a motion picture, because they showed newsreels before the actual film. Television brought it right into your home. And that was a major shift, especially in the 1960s. When you look at civil rights, when you mm-hmm. look at the Vietnam War, when you look at all those great movements that exploded in the 1960s, television was the window. I mean, we knew things were going on down in the South with Jim Crow and all that stuff. We were aware of segregation, but it wasn't until we saw Bull Connor and his police force literally, hosing down and beating up, Black people in the streets of Birmingham. We saw it on television. Then we went, oh my goodness, something has to be done. We have to change.
And something about the visual channel of input made a huge difference in how we reacted to it.
Yeah. The thing that's interesting though, is in the last 20 years, there's been a great decentralization due to the smartphone. Mm-hmm. When you think about the George Floyd situation, in fact, think about anything today, any type of news, the minute something happens, people have got their smartphones recording. And before mm-hmm. long, it's posted online. And we see, you know, we see information, we see news often even as it's happening today. And it's done through the smartphone technology. And we are all the producers. We're the commentators. We're the filmmakers. We're the news reporters.
The podcasters.
We're the podcasters. And what's, you know, what we're doing today, you know, 20 years ago, you had to have to be in an elite group. You had to have special access. You know, but now we can do it freely. That is the democratization that the internet, television was the earliest. Also, I think any type of mobile technology, cell phone, has done through our culture. Mm-hmm. So that's the big cultural shift that I've seen. When I look back as a historian, I look at how technologies can shift us. And I look 500 years ago, it was the Gutenberg press. It was the mechanical clock. It was the scopes, the microscope and the telescope that shifted us, moved us out of the dark ages into what's conventionally called the dark ages, into what we call modernity or a modern culture. Now, because of television, internet, mobile cell phone technology, we have shifted into a postmodern culture, and that all the rules are new. All the rules are different. And, you know, how long will it be? It's interesting. We don't know. But this historian, as I've looked back, I tend to see big chunks, big cultural shifts about every 500 years. Yeah. And then from there, we have generational shifts. And that's where I started taking the big shift and going, well, if technology, this has always been my thesis, if technology is what shifts cultural languages so that we speak, we communicate, we do business, we are entertained, we socialize, you know, we learn all those things. If they shift in these big ways every 500 years, you know, do they also not have smaller, those micro shifts mm-hmm. happening from generation to generation? And when I funneled that through the last 120 years, I was shocked to see about every 10 years, a new technology popping. Okay. And so we're not boomers, Jay. We're the space and television generation. We're not Gen X. We're the cable television and video game generation. We're not millennials. We're the personal computer, cell phone, and net generation.
So you're naming the generations based on the technology.
Right. So when I look at, you know, people today refer to Gen Z. Mm-hmm. Gen Z is a lousy name. It's one of the reasons I got upset and wrote a book. You know, mm-hmm. most authors write a book because they're upset. And that's why I wrote the book. I think Gen Z is one of the worst names. Gen X was right up there. But Gen Z is even worse, because Gen Z is just nothing more than using the alphabet to name a generation. It's a marketing term at best. So when I look at those born since the year 2000, I see them as iTechs, little I, big T, because of the iTechnologies that frame them. Technologies like the iTunes or iPod or iPad or iPhone or iWatch, social media. That's why you can't look at someone born, you know, the teenagers today are going to be so much different than we were as teenagers. Now that we have similar developmental issues, we have similar temptations and stresses and, you know, issues, but in general, because technology has shifted and there's a change, we have a different perspective. And it's these perspectives then that become these generation gaps. And what's interesting, I think, and I'll close on this thought, is while the tipping points have shrunk, I think the generation gap is getting greater and greater. There's a huge difference today between someone who's 55 years old and someone who's 15. And
you know, I would imagine so, because if the tipping points are happening faster, there's more resistance, I would imagine, from the older generation, who probably would be adopting things a little slower. There's a study, I can't quite remember it, about, you know, it was an island with monkeys. Mm-hmm. It's monkeys on an island, and they would eat these coconuts or some fruit that would fall from the tree. And at one point the coconut fell, or the fruit fell into the water and got a salty taste to it. So the monkey showed his friends, you know, this is a great way to add a nice taste to the food. Hmm. And pretty soon all of the younger monkeys were doing it. The older monkeys never picked up on that. So there's an innate nature to learn from our elders.
Yeah.
But the elders don't necessarily learn from the youth.
And I think you just nailed it, because when it comes down to it, in reality, the uncomfortability of something is about personal taste. In this case, the taste of salt was the difference.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times it's just personal taste. I just prefer this. I prefer to communicate through Snapchat. I prefer to communicate through TikTok. You want to stay on Facebook? Okay, boomer, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to these other platforms.
Yeah. And just to know, I'm generalizing, this is not going to be a case in every point in every case, I should say. So yeah. And now you bring up another interesting point about the different platforms and personal taste is sharing information or data amongst these platforms. So one of the downsides I see to the current digital age is data. Just our personal data, or the data that we generate, is in the hands of these corporate conglomerates, these internet corporate giants, who have done great things for us, by the way. They've evolved technologies quite impressively that we are all benefiting from. But now that as the internet evolved, I thought, okay, this is a platform that's going to provide more democracy and more freedom to humanity. But now we have this concentration in the hands of these internet giants with data. And so I'm kind of envisioning a way that data can be shared amongst these platforms so that people can use the platforms that they choose, but still communicate with people using other platforms, somehow sharing the data. It's kind of a vision that I have for moving forward. Yeah.
Well, again, this is something that's different. And what you're speaking to is, and I think that the shift, and again, this is a micro shift, the smartphone introduced it. And slowly with each generation of the smartphone, we were introduced to other types of smart technology, smart speakers, mm-hmm. like Siri. And in fact, if you think about Siri, most people don't think about Siri. That's an interesting name. But do you know what Siri backwards spells? Spell it backwards.
Iris.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
It's got its eye on you, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Siri always has its eye on you. And I don't think we realize that. I mean, that was just one of those things. And I don't think that was unintentional. I think that was purposely named that for it was just, how can we give it a name that's different than any other name? You know, Alexa is very, it's obtuse, if you will. But when you get to Siri, all right, well, I have no idea what that means, but backwards, Iris. Now it starts to come. And this is what artificial intelligence does. In my book, I talk about the robotics generation. That's the last generation born since 2010, the robo generation. And they're growing up in what I call a hair technology culture. Hair standing for holographic AI, artificial intelligence, and R, robotics. So that middle piece of artificial intelligence is what's new. And for those of us who are older, this is also the creepiest part for us. I mean, we can handle a robot that vacuums our floor. That doesn't bother us at all. But we have a problem with, a device, a smart speaker, actually knowing everything about our lives, possibly listening into our lives, being so connected with our lives that it becomes part of the family type of stuff. This is where artificial intelligence is going. It's literally making, think about when robots actually become smart robots, and they're very close right now, but they become not only smart, but they become truly humanoid. Japan is on the forefront, the cutting edge of this type of technology, where they're creating robots that are so closely to being human that they've got one that I watched online. She's a reporter, a journalist, and she will sit down. It's a robot, a humanoid robot. Mm-hmm. And she looks non-human. I mean, when you look at her, but she literally, as she communicates with her guests, she's learning their story, and she's learned certain questions to ask, just like you have as a podcaster, to get a conversation going. And then as the guest speaks and shares, she picks up on that and she learns. And that's what's different. We used to learn our machines. We used to learn our calculators. We used to put the algorithms into our computers. That's why they were called computers. We would do the computing. Now our machines are learning us. And that is a shift that our kids are very, it's like fish in water. They're comfortable with it. For those of us who are living on land right now, to jump into that artificial intelligence waters is potentially a drowning moment for us.
Yeah, and it might make us a little nervous.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Which I think is where your blockchain, you know, we were talking about blockchain before, blockchain technology sounds to me, and I don't know a lot about blockchain. You're obviously the expert on that, Jay, but for me, what I've looked at it, it's much more secure. You know, when you look at it from the financial perspective of Bitcoin, it's and cryptocurrency, it's much more secure. And it's, you can't manipulate it. You know, unlike a lot of data that gets out there, you can manipulate, which should concern you when you think about it. If you can have data manipulated on you, so you could have a spotless record. You could be a perfect citizen. But if the wrong people, the wrong nefarious people get a hold of your, you know, persona online, and they can make you into some sort of a bad guy by changing your data. I mean, I don't think most people even Google their names. I think some, I actually had a friend, he says he's scared to Google his name because he's afraid of what he might find out. I'm going, that might be the reason to Google your name.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of bad things out there, you know, just bad information, wrong information.
Misinformation, disinformation.
Misinformation, disinformation. You know, those are the kind of the two.
That's another issue that I think is we're trying to deal with, learn how to deal with in this expanding, rapidly evolving digital age. Misinformation, disinformation, and data. The term that I wanted to share with you is the democratization of data. And decentralization of data. Decentralization is what blockchain does, but it's not appropriate for large amounts of information because of the distribution. It's got to be distributed, but it can be used for ledgers and small amounts of information or hash representations of large amounts of data. So it's a good tool for that to authenticate data within the blockchain. Decentralized. You use the word decentralized quite a bit in your talk about the evolution of technology.
Yeah.
And I think that's the trend that we are seeing.
Yeah. And that's right. When you look at, in fact, that Generation Z, which I call the iTechs, I when I teach about them, train about them, I like to say they're a 3D generation. And the three D's that define those individuals born since year 2000 is, first of all, they're digital. They're wholly digital. Secondly, they're diverse. They're the most diverse American generation in the history of America. And then thirdly, decentralized. They are growing up in a totally decentralized culture, which is going to make them very, very easily, I don't want to use the word, let's just use the word open. They're easily open to decentralized cultures, decentralized organizations, decentralized environments
and resources. Yeah, decentralized data, that's where I'm hoping we're evolving to, especially with blockchain technology. I hope it brings us to that. And that's the mission of TrueDemocracy.Global is to help bring that about as far as communities and voting goes, storing votes within a platform that can't be tampered with or altered, and bringing the power to the communities and the people that are in it. Now, as far as authority goes, in this over the 19th century, what have you seen as far as our trust of authority and our respect of authority with the evolution of technology?
Well, I think that's pretty pretty clear. I mean, both trust and respect in every way we have lost along the way with our technology. Social media, I think, depending on your perspective, I tend to look at it from more of a positive view. I think that there's Facebook, for example, that's primarily where I do a lot of my work. Facebook has been a very positive experience in that I'm an encouraging type of guy and I like to bring people together. I often connect. Just recently, I had a student in one of my churches that I worked with many, many years ago. She has cancer. And I was also friends with a youth leader that worked with her back in those days. And they had somehow gotten disconnected. And I was able to put them together through Facebook. You know, and you think about high school reunions, you know, I mean, those have totally shifted. I just had my 40th high school reunion, which was a lot of fun. But I remember back on our 20th high school reunion which was in 2011 was our 20th high school reunion. And I remember, that'd be our 30th. It was our 30th. And I remember how social media had shifted, because when we came back for our 20th, we didn't know each other. Mm-hmm. So we were constantly catching up. What'd you do? Now we know each other because we know the mm-hmm. stories. We know the struggles. We know the problems people are having. We know their joys. We know their successes because it's all over social media. And that's the benefit, I think, of especially Facebook, where it stores your stories, it stores your moments, it stores your posts and creates what they call a memory feed. I don't know if you ever go back and look at your memory feed on Facebook, but to me, it's fascinating. Usually most days I actually will go back and take a look just to see what I did on this day throughout. And I've been on Facebook since 2004, but
early adopter.
2005, maybe 2006, to be mm-hmm. honest. I think Facebook actually was born in 2004, but I was a professor at the time and all my students were on Facebook. And that's when I learned about it. And I got on Facebook because that's where my students were at and I could communicate better with them. But at that point, Facebook was only for educational institutions. It wasn't open to anybody else. So as a professor, I was able to have early access. Mm-hmm. So I've been among the early adopters of social media. I played around with MySpace for about 24 hours. And then I said, nah, not for me. Facebook tended to have some more utilitarian purposes that were useful.
For me.
It's more pragmatic.
It's definitely changed quite a bit. And I think it's something that we're taking for granted quite a bit as well. These days.
Yeah. Well, you look at what YouTube is doing. YouTube is another one of those big giant platforms. But when I was researching GenTech, I actually took each chapter. And one of the things I did was I spent a whole day doing nothing but watching YouTube videos and the history, you know, and we're not talking about somebody else telling you the history of these things, which was always helpful too. We're talking about like with the motion picture generation, I was able to go back and watch early motion pictures on YouTube, including the Great Train Robbery, which I think was 1912.
Something like that. Yeah.
Birth of a Nation, which was 1915, a very significant D.W. Griffith movie that really defined what we call the epic movie. It had other problems with it and controversies, of course, but if you're familiar with that movie. But as a movie maker, as a motion picture genre, it there were these shifts and you can actually go back and watch it. You can go watch, Edison did a number of early movies. He had his own movie company and they're all online and you can watch these early movies, you know, the Edison sneeze, as they call it, where he captured somebody sneezing. Well, if you'd never seen that on film before, it just blows your mind. For us today, it's just it's just somebody sneezing, but that's history.
So on demand, that's another shift that is
and the big thing that's happening is it's we the people. All right, I'm not sure I'm going to ever release another book. This may be my last book for a major publisher, unless a publisher comes and offers me a deal I can't refuse. I am literally moving to self-publishing and doing all my writing freely, mm-hmm. and, you know, finding other ways to, because for me, it's just, it's not, you know, the book market has been totally decimated by the digitization of culture. It's just, you know, and by 2050, we won't have books, and I love books. If I turn this screen around, you'd see my entire office is nothing but books.
Uh-huh.
I have books everywhere. I love them, but I know, you know, when you can put all, you can put an entire library. In fact, I'm doing this right now. Google Books is digitizing a lot of early books. And today, for example, I'm doing a lot of Black History study this month because of Black History Month here in February when we recorded this. And, you know, I read today from a book that was written in 1880, 1882 about Black history in the 1800s.
Online, and digitized.
Fascinating.
Wow.
It's fascinating. And I actually can save it as a PDF, and mm-hmm. I'm slowly building. I got probably a bigger digital library of PDFs from Google Books now than I do in my own personal library, because these take up shelf space.
Yeah, right. So the evolution of writing from when the PC was introduced, mm-hmm. I think the publication of books jumped by 500%.
Yeah,
was the stat. I couldn't find any numbers on that, but that's about what I calculated based on the information that I could get about 20 years ago when I did that research. And now you're seeing it decline, you're right. saying. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, again, technology, particularly think about what Twitter has done. I call it the Doogie Howser effect. You remember Doogie Howser? Did you ever watch that show back in the 90s?
No.
Neil Patrick Harris? No. Yeah, Neil Patrick Harris was all about maybe 18 years old at the time, uh-huh. playing this kid. I don't think he was 18, maybe he was 16. He was just a kid. He was basically a boy genius, Doogie Howser, MD. But it ran for a few seasons. But at the end of every Doogie Howser, he would summarize his show with just a little entry on his computer. So you get on his computer and you'd write a 1 or 2 sentence entry. He was the first Twitter. He was the yeah. first tweeter. I mean, that's what we did. 140 characters. He was doing it back in the 1990s. And now what's happened is we've become addicted to that frame. We want our information short, brief, succinct. Just tell me the facts and move on. If you try to do anything too long, you get in trouble. Although I'm finding I write about 700 to 1,000 word essays every single day. I post them on Facebook and I have regular readers. I have people tell me I read your stuff all the time.
So you're digitizing your writing, probably mm-hmm. won't write another book, making it available freely. You make that available on Facebook.
Well, I'm not saying I won't make the book available freely. I'm saying that I'll probably self-publish it maybe okay. through Amazon okay. and do something like that where it's a PDF, or through I have a website where you can download even right now some of my books by PDF books for $5. I just do a $5 download.
Okay.
But I run a nonprofit organization, and so basically we call it a donation to our work. You're donating $5 and I'll give you a book as a result.
It's, mm-hmm.
you know.
So where can people find it if they want to look at your writing?
Best place is rickcromie.com. That's where you can start, rickcromie.com. You can also find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, all the places you want to be, Jay, online.
Okay. Rick Cromie is spelled C-H-R-O-M-E-Y.
Rickcromie.com.
Okay. Now, what else do we have to talk about?
Well, this is your show, Jay.
Let's go back to authority mm-hmm. and the evolution of the decentralization of authority in evolution. Now, I don't know how far back you go in history in your studies. How far back do you go?
As far as the book, it goes back to 1900. Mm-hmm. I have started. COVID actually got me researching more the 1800s and really since the founding of America. So 1700s, 1800s, I started doing a lot more research in that area. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of my writing right now comes out of that particular period only. You know, for example, Black history, which is what I'm writing right now, a lot of Black history profiles. I'm spotlighting Black Americans who we've forgotten. You know, we know about the Frederick Douglasses and the, you know, Martin Luther Kings and the George Washington Carvers, those individuals, but, mm-hmm. you know, Clara Brown and, you know, Biddy Mason and some of these individuals, you know, Robert Hansen, those type of individuals we've lost. We've lost their names. We've lost their stories. So part of what I'm doing is recapturing that. So yeah, that's kind of the period that I've been writing in lately.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And as a historian, you're not necessarily looking forward, right? You're looking back.
Yeah. As a historian, what we tend to do is look for patterns. We look for stories. Mm-hmm. I like to look for interesting stories, in particular stories that I've not heard. And I like to, you know, kind of dust them off and bring them back, give them a new shine and, you know, maybe what I would call chromeize them or something like that. Give them a little chrome, you know, spit shine, bring them back and tell the story anew. That's what makes Gentech, I think, such a fun book to read. You know, I think you have the book and it's one of those things. It's a fun book to read because it's nothing but a lot of stories. You know, I was amazed about the controversy between electronic and mechanical television, for mm-hmm. example. You know, and here in Idaho, where I live, we all hear about Philo T. Farnsworth. You know, Philo T. Farnsworth was the founder of television. Well, there's a whole narrative out there that says somebody else did that. Somebody else founded television. And Zworkin, his name was Zworkin, a Russian guy. And, you know, he was the one that invented television. But a court ruled back in the late 1920s that Philo T. Farnsworth had the patent. He had the original patent on electronic television. So from that perspective, I do agree that he is the inventor mm-hmm. of television. But Zworkin, who eventually got connected with NBC radio, and it was NBC and Zworkin that working in tandem together that did their best to erase what we might call it, revise that type of history. Mm-hmm. So that P.T. Farnsworth was, or Philo T. Farnsworth was kind of knocked out of that story. In the book I mentioned, there's a legendary moment in the 60s where Philo T. Farnsworth is on that show. I think it's What's Your Line or What's Your Name or something like that, where people have to guess his identity. And mm-hmm. he talks about himself being the founder of, or the inventor of television. Nobody knew who he was. Nobody knew who he was. And when he passed away, if it wasn't for his widow, a lot of the information about Philo T. Farnsworth would be lost. Mm. Out in Eastern Idaho, there is an entire museum dedicated in his hometown to television. And it's an amazing place to visit and study, you know, the early technology of television. But yeah, I mean, those are the stories that I like to recapture. And bring back and help us understand. You know, another one is just the area of space technology. You know, we all know that space technology was as we were in this race with the Russians to the moon in the 1960s, we were relying upon our scientists. What we didn't realize was, and most Americans didn't realize, and we don't realize today, is that those scientists were largely German scientists who had rocket expertise. They had created a rocket. These were German Nazis that had created the what was called the Vengeance 2 rocket back at the very end of World War II. And as Americans were, as we were going in and scouring through Europe looking for Hitler and looking for Nazis, we came across these V2, as they called them, V2 prototypes and V2 documents showed how to make them. And we did what was called Operation Paperclip. And I can't remember how many we brought back. I want to think anywhere from 75 to 150. I'd have to go back and look at the actual number, but it was a substantial amount. We literally, Operation Paperclip, brought back all these German scientists and we put them on bases all over America, primarily a couple, and we just did nothing with them. You know, these scientists, these German scientists, these German engineers, these German rocketeers basically just sat on their thumbs for almost two decades until Sputnik went up. And America went, oh, our leaders went, wow, we got to be doing something about this. And the only people who knew anything about rockets were these German Nazi scientists.
Interesting. And
that's who we can thank for putting us on the moon. It was German scientists.
Well, that's an interesting story. And I just want to get back to the theme of change and evolution, that also the space technology is something else that's becoming decentralized.
Right. Right. Yeah. You're seeing that with Elon Musk and
rockets.
Yeah.
So it's besides decentralization, what's the other, are there any other trends that you see?
Well, other than the digitization, the decentralization of our, of everything, you know, obviously, again, the holographic artificial intelligence and robotics, those are the micro technologies that are going to pop. Trust me, by the year 2030, it's going to look like a whole new world out there. Mm-hmm. You will see robots everywhere. In fact, I was just talking with somebody last night. They said the NBC News did a piece on the Olympics, a story on the Olympic kitchen and cafeteria. And I didn't see this, so this is coming second hand. But they said that the entire cafeteria over there with the Olympians is all the food is created by robots. It's all delivered by robots.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow is right. Because it's like that, you know, and see, here's the problem in our COVID culture right now. We're having a hard time. A lot of small businesses, a lot of restaurants are having a hard time finding workers. Well, guess where that job's going to go in the future? As soon as we take the money and they put the investments in robots, robots will be serving us. Robots will be cooking for us. There's already, I think it's called Zoom, Z-U-M-E, Zoom Pizza. It's about 3/4 of the pizza pie itself is made by robots, you know?
Yeah.
And then we deliver it by a drone. What's a drone? Drone's a robot.
Yeah.
That's our world.
So I'm sure there's a concern that this could increase the gap between the haves and the have-nots, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And again, technology tends to do that. But at the same time, think about a smartphone. I mean, they're not cheap. A smartphone's not cheap. And yet, last I saw, what was it, 90% of cell phone users have a smartphone? So, you know, obviously, even the have-nots have a way of figuring out how to get a hold of one. Certain technologies do that. Think about television. Television is, you know, as we have more of it, a lot of that, those prices will come down. But at the same time, look at car prices right now. A lot of that's due to supply chain, but car prices are horrendous. You know, what was the average car price in America today is $47,000. Are you kidding me? Do you realize that in 1920, $47,000 would buy you a mansion in town?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Today it buys you a car.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So money is, and a lot of that inflation, of course, is due to printing money. It's just, we're just printing money left and right now. And it'll be interesting to see where it takes us.
Yeah. Yeah. Only time will tell. We have to get on the train, which we all are, and take the ride and do our best.
Take the ride.
So there's a question on your list here that might be leading us in another direction, but I wanted to ask you, why do children and teens act up or act out?
Well, that is way off topic.
Maybe.
Maybe. Well, I do have a, in my former life, I was a youth pastor and an education professor. And so I dealt a lot with teachers and such. And one of the number one problem today is with teaching and even parenting is just discipline. And, you know, so I started, I started thinking the one, I think I had, it actually originated with an article. I was asked to write an article on why kids misbehave.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it all came from. It was just, I was trying to think of what would be simple. I want to make things simple. You know, again, educators, the best educators and really take hard things and make them simple. So when I was thinking about, misbehavior, there were really only three reasons I could see that in general, and I'm talking in general, children, teenagers, really adults as well, but primarily children and teenagers misbehave. The greatest one is belonging. They're having a trouble fitting in, finding community, finding, you know, the connection with the subject, with the teacher, with their peers.
Mm-hmm.
So they act up and act out. They wave a flag basically and say, hey, I'm not fitting in. And so that can be a very, in fact, 80% of a lot, 80% of misbehavior, I think, in the home as well as in the classroom is belonging issues.
Mm-hmm.
And that's correctable by both the parent and the teacher.
So that's this. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead. Ask your question.
I was going to ask exactly what you were about to say. What's the next one?
Yeah. The next one is boredom.
Boredom.
You know, yeah. We act up when we're bored.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the attention span of a preteen or a preschooler is directly related to their age. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're 2 years old, you have a 2 minute attention span. If you're 5 year old, you have a 5 minute attention span. If you're 16 year old, you have a 4 minute attention span. And the reason for that is because of social media.
Uh-huh.
The average YouTube video is 4 minutes long. So teenagers today have been grooved by social media, micromedia, Snapchat, TikTok, Twitter, these other types of social media where everything's very short, to have short attention spans. The last one is simply beliefs. These are inner beliefs that we have about ourselves, often framed by our environment. Mm-hmm. And it emerges in our preteen years. You don't see little kids dealing with this so much, but you do see 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds, and certainly teenagers struggling with what they believe about themselves. And, you know, they already have put themselves inside a box. And that's one of my jobs, again, as an educator, even as a parent, was to help my child know that, hey, listen, we got to get you outside of this. And you're bigger than the box that other people put you in, mm-hmm. including your parents. Our parents can put us in boxes that can be horrific mm-hmm. boxes that we live with on our entire life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the reason why I asked this is to tie it back into technology.
Okay.
And how do you see our digital age affecting these three issues?
Well, obviously, again, with boredom, it's very simple. You know, social media technology, we tend to babysit. And this is nothing new. Again, I think the radio, in some ways, I think you go all the way back to motion picture generation. I mean, what'd you do when you were bored? You know, when you're feeling, you went and saw a movie.
Yeah.
You know, get it out of the house, go down to the movie house. Yeah. You know, you turned on the radio eventually and you listened to, you know, Molly Fibber and Fibber McGee or whoever, you know,
read a book.
Yeah.
But Mad Magazine.
The technology tended to become a babysitter. Television, particularly for those of us born post 1960, became a huge, huge babysitter. A lot of times we came home, we were known as latchkey children mm-hmm. as well. This generation, we'd come home, nobody was at home to watch us. So we'd turn on the television. For me, it was three channels. Two of them were Snowy. I call them weather channels, but you know, we'd watch, you know, the Brady Bunch reruns, or we'd watch Bewitched or something like that. Or, you know, Gilligan's Island, you know, pretty innocuous stuff. But with cable television, there was introduced, which came about in the 80s, As the later generations, the babysitting became more PG oriented, more even R rated at times. And then when you could go into your room and televisions became something that parents allowed, you know, when you had a television in every single room, I know people have televisions in their bathrooms. It's like, really? You know, it's just things have changed and television became that space. And now what's happened is the internet and the cell phone. You know, think about how the cell phone now is a part of everything we are. Mm-hmm. You know, if you lose your cell phone, it's like a death in the family. You know, it's very difficult. I mean, you go through the same grief process until you find your phone or you try to recover your life.
Yeah.
Have you ever had a hard drive crash, Jay?
Oh, geez. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember one time I had just finished an entire book and I was about ready to send it off to the publisher and I got the blue screen moment, lost the entire book.
Oh, geez.
And I was under a deadline. I literally had to sequester myself away. And for two straight weeks, I wrote an entire book. It was unbelievable. I didn't do anything. And I was sure at the end, I was crazy. It was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But, you know, today, I used to think the cloud was somewhat secure, but you know, I'm not so convinced of that. I had an issue with my Mac and I put everything up in my Mac, my cloud through my Mac, and they're constantly talking to each other. Well, I had a situation where it was duplicating data and I don't know how that happened, but it was actually duplicating. So I kept running out of space,
space. Yeah.
And then it kept shooting it up, except it was only shooting up parts. In the end, I lost probably in this last one, I think 40% of my data, including a lot of music that I had, you know, I thought it was all up in the cloud.
That's another technology that's evolving and getting better. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, back to the question about the teens acting out. I wanted to ask that in relation to technology today and also tie it into trust and respect of authority. And right. I was just wondering if there was a trend in the 19th century related to technology about that caused teens to act out more or had an effect on that aspect.
Yeah, well, there have been a number of studies that show how smartphones in particular have contributed to a lot more delinquency. Mm-hmm. Even narcissism, as well as just general depression, suicide. A lot of those have been linked to social media and smartphone use. And, you know, that again is unique. It's unique to one generation born since 2000, because those of us who are older, we didn't have that. Even millennials didn't have that. They went through similar struggles, but they didn't deal with it as specific as that. The idea of being cyber bullied, you know, that was relatively, you know, that emerged a bit in the late millennial generation. But yeah, so
we had the television and Buckminster Fuller, who we talked about before, not in this conversation, but he agreed with you about that leading towards the cultural revolution in the 60s. And he specifically said, suddenly there was another authority in the house.
Yeah,
it wasn't exactly just the parents. So here we had a whole generation that was acting out.
Yeah.
And so today we have just mass amounts of information at our fingertips. And so there's unlimited authorities
that
can affect our beliefs.
Right.
And contradiction or to what our authority figures in our schools, families, or communities might say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for those of us who are born in the 60s and 70s, particularly the 60s, it was interesting. In the 1970s, we had a slew of movies that involved children, but the movies were very negative. They were anti-child. You know, you think about, The Exorcist and how this little girl was possessed. You think about Bad News Bears. We were Goonies, you know. we were just bad kids. You know, and even in the 80s, so when we grew up and in the 80s, then even though they brought in more wholesome family fare, that I call it the Disney effect upon television, we start looking at television programming, you know, you had everything from family ties to Home Improvement, those type of shows, Cosby, all those came in the late 80s and 90s. And it was a good shift. And that, a lot of that was because the millennial generation was being born, but there was also a repercussion. There was a backside, let's call it a backwash. You also had The Simpsons. You also had Roseanne. You had Married with Children, which tended to look at these family units not as wholesome, not as good, not as productive, but more as highly dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm. You know, the dysfunctional and aspect.
I'll be honest, I actually related more with Roseanne than I did with The Cosby Show.
Yeah. You
know? And it's not about a black or white issue there. I'm talking about, you know, in The Cosby Show, both of them were a very high earning. I think he was a pediatrician and she was a lawyer. They were making a lot of money. The kids were well off. It was a wealthy home. And both parents were functional. It was different than my mom was more like Roseanne than Claire Huxtable, you know?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that did have an impact then as far as how we acted out, you know, because there is an argument about media, and I'll close on this, is that does media reflect what's going on in culture, or is it a mirror? You know, is it a producer? And by that, does it mirror it? You know, so is it already out there in culture, and all television does, all the movies do, is all the music does, is it just mirroring it, or is it actually on the cutting edge and it's producing? And, you know, there can be an argument made for both sides.
I think so. I think so. Okay. One more question. And I'm hoping you can answer this really quick, even though it sounds like it might be a loaded question. In your book title, you say, who we really are. So who are we really?
Well, that's what I'm saying. We're not the baby boom generation. We are the space and television generation. We're
defined.
We're more technology. Defined by the technology that was bubbling, and it bubbles about our 10th birthday. Every generation is about 20 years long, but every 10 years, there's a new technology that is bubbling, that's tipping. And it's, you know, starts off with the telephone and transportation generation in 1900, then the motion picture in 1910, and then the radio in 1920, and then you've got vinyl records in 1930, and 1940 it's television, and 1950 it's space, and 1960 it's the video game generation starts to emerge, in 1970 it's the cable television that starts to emerge. In 1980, it's the personal computer and cell phone. And in 1990, it's the internet that starts to emerge. And the year 2000, it's those iTechs that I've talked about. And in the year 2010, it's robotics.
Oh, and blockchain too.
Yeah. And blockchain plays a part of that.
Yeah.
Okay. Blockchain being more recent in that technology.
Yeah.
That'll be in my next book. I'll have to have Jay be my expert witness for my blockchain comments.
Yeah. We'll see what we can do with that. It's been a delight to talk to you. I feel like I could talk on and on, but we want to appreciate and respect the attention span of our listeners. Visit Rick Cromie at rickcromie.com. You can get more information about who he is, what he does, and as well purchase his book and other writings on his website. The True Democracy.Global podcast mission is to explore topics related to democracy and systems of authority, as well as the technologies that support them. We cast a wide net to bring in information from a variety of sources with the intention of shedding light in every corner and illuminating a broad and deep understanding of the systems that exist, past and present. With this understanding, we refine our nonprofit mission, which supports our vision to build trust, encourage constructive collaboration, and provide an avenue for the authenticity of and the secure storage of information. Please visit truedemocracy.global for more information. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Jay.